so that workforce housing is not necessarily bad housing. It's not necessarily crime-ridden or has other significant issues. It's just not going to be as nice as the beat.
Welcome to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals who work with investors, buyers, and sellers of commercial real estate coast to coast. Whether you're an investor, broker, lender, property manager, attorney, or accountant, we're here to learn from the experts.
Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio. This is episode number 64. Weekly, we share interviews with real estate experts passing on their experience and knowledge. Thanks for joining us this week. My name is Jader and Gross. We're so glad you're here. In just a minute, we're going to speak with John Wilhoit. John is an author, he's an investor, he's an asset manager, and he's also a returning guest to the program. On one of our most popular episodes, episode number 26, John provides an in-depth description of the characteristics in different markets from primary to rural. Today, John's back to take us through multifamily property class characteristics from A to B, C, and all other. I know you'll find this informative, and John's experience is second to none. Before we get started, though, if you're a returning listener, I want to welcome you and thank you for coming back. If you're a first-time listener, I want to welcome you to our show and tell you a little bit about myself. I am a real estate investor. I'm also a commercial insurance broker. I've been an insurance broker for 25-plus years. My primary clients are real estate professionals dealing in multifamily, retail, warehouse, office, and development. Also, I'm a real estate investor and have been for 20-plus years. And it's because of this that I'm always looking for more information about real estate investing, whether it be to support my clients or to use my own investing. My goal is to learn and share with you info that you can put to use in your own real estate investing. And that's how Commercial Real Estate Pro Network and CREPN Radio came about. The easiest way to reach me is you can go to the contact button on commercialrealestatepronetwork.com. And if you haven't yet, I want to invite you to subscribe to the show if you like what we're doing. You can do it on either iTunes or Stitcher, whichever you prefer. It's really, really easy. Just go to the one you prefer, iTunes or Stitcher, type in Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. And when you see our logo, it's the headphones with CREPN between the ears. Go ahead and click subscribe, and that way you'll make certain you don't miss any of our episodes. And you can listen anytime you like, whether it be in the car at the gym or if you're out walking the dog. When you subscribe, this helps us when we're trying to attract guests because the measuring stick for podcasts are the number of subscribers and listeners. So anything, if you do that, that'd be a big help for us to get guests. Also want to mention, if you're in the middle of a contract or if you've got a property and there's an insurance question, if you'd like a second opinion, I welcome the opportunity to talk to you about it. You can go ahead and reach out to me and I'll be glad to give you, my two cents and let you know what I could do for you if you're interested in that. Go ahead and contact me. And if I can help you, that's what I will do that. Cause that's what I do. On the insurance, side of things too, I just want to mention, currently I'm involved in a continuing ed class. It's on risk management. And one of the topics that's come up here that I wanted to just touch on real quick is negligence. And there's four elements in negligence. There's a duty that you have. I mean, these are the four elements that must be present. There's a duty. There's a breach of that duty. There's a cause of an incident, which you have to have a direct cause to the incident. And then there's damages. And the reason I bring this up is if you're not aware, I've got a checklist that I make available to anybody that's interested. You can go to the commercialrealestatepronetwork.com and right there on the page there's a checklist you can download. But it'll help you if you don't have any system in place to evaluate your property and try and recognize any deferred maintenance or any issues that might give you potential negligent issues down the road. And, you know, that can involve, typically negligence is associated with liability. The property checklist we typically tend to think of as more of a keep your property in good shape. But I just, the negligence thing, it's there.
And I would hate for you to have a lawsuit that you could have avoided. So go ahead and check that out. You can get that at commercialrealestatepronetwork.com. Lastly, before we get on with the show, if you're on LinkedIn, go ahead and check out our group, Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. It's a great place to network with commercial real estate professionals. All right, let's get on with the show. On the line with me today, I'm fortunate to have a returning guest, John Wilhoit. John was a guest on episode number 26, where we got into the different markets. We took a look at primary, secondary, tertiary, and rural markets. John, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's been a while. It's been a while, but I'm glad to be back with you.
I'm glad you were able to, or we were able to make this work. I know the episode's been a popular one, and hopefully anybody that hasn't listened to it will take the opportunity to go back and check it out, because it was full of good information on distinguishing the difference between the various markets. But before we get into today's program, John, if you could give the listeners a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your background.
Sure. I've been in real estate most of my professional career. I have an undergraduate degree in business from Pepperdine and a master's degree in urban planning from Alabama A&M. Professionally, my focus has been institutional multifamily assets, working for some of the largest owners and operators in the United States, and also as an asset manager in government for HUD for a little while, but predominantly working for merchant builders, property management companies, at least these last 10 years as a consultant on their behalf.
Yeah. Now, I think if memory serves, you say you did work at HUD for a little while, correct?
Yes, within public and Indian housing, or what they refer to as PIH. And that role was predominantly with working with housing authorities in some of the larger cities within the U.S. and bringing some of the HUD programs to those housing authorities, which included mixed finance housing, where there was a partnership or private-public partnership between the public sector executive director of the housing authority or the housing authority and private sector developers or general contractors to build developments that would allow for what we called mixed finance and mixed income communities. And the mixed finance just meant that there was some financing provided or funding provided by the housing authority and some provided by private sector lenders in some instances. And then the mixed income part of it was assuring that we built communities that didn't just have a single set of residents, those that were only low income, those that were only low to moderate income, but building communities that would allow people of every income to reside there along with lower income community, along with the lower income community within that development.
Well, I know, you know, after talking with you and I've had some other interviews with some others that are I mean, their practice is all about the affordable housing and all that. That's a topic that we might want to come back and revisit. It's fascinating, and just the way that the financing comes together and how all that works and I know that a lot of the construction that I've been made aware of, at least around in Portland, is actually affordable housing right now. So I know it's an active sector, and there's a lot of construction going on to meet the need.
It's really an industry within our industry. So
right,
and it's very, very large.
Right, right. Well, we will make plans to possibly go back and, or at a later date, come back and talk about that. But today, I asked John to come on to the program, and he agreed, and I'm grateful for that. But we wanted to get into the differentiation between the characteristics of different properties. And what I'm talking about is the grading scale that gets applied to properties. You've got your A, your B, your C, and your D, and then you can go plus or minus on each one of those like you can a grade card. And so with that, John, I don't know if it's easiest just to start at one end and work our way to the other end, or would it make sense to do that and then kind of cite the different characteristics of each?
Well, let me set the table.
Okay.
by suggesting that the initial podcast that you and I did was really all about markets and the differentiation between a primary and secondary market and what those look like. So you really have to have that as a backstop to looking at the actual grade of individual assets or the asset class. So let's put two more layers in there even before we get to class, because class is the easy part if you understand the other parameters that we've put in. So our prior podcast was about markets and differentiating markets and even differentiating markets within markets, which we call submarkets. So that podcast was all about that segment. So before I get into class here, let me talk about patterns with respect to markets, because this is another layer that's necessary in the distinction of the class of properties. So the patterns I'd like you to consider, and it's kind of a bullet point here, so if you're taking notes, it'll be short and sweet, but there's 5 points or 5 patterns to look at within markets, even before you get to property class. And the first one is census data. Within census data, you're looking at household income, family size, the average age. Those are all data points that are just on the census track. So that's one of the patterns to review within a market that you're looking to buy assets. Another one is traffic patterns. Everyone wants to know, is that particular property, does it have 500 cars a day going by the property, 5,000, or is it 5? And there are properties all across the country that have each of those going for it, right? I mean, sometimes they're positive, sometimes they're negative. So people want to be tucked away from the traffic, but yet they want to be close to proximity to shopping, medical, and jobs. So you can't be too far tucked away. So if you're not too far tucked away, it means you've got some traffic close or within or in front of your property. So that's another pattern to review. What's the traffic pattern? What's the car count going by that asset? Another one is building permits, because that's a tell as terms about the number of units that are coming online, along with demolition, those units that are going offline that are no longer available for housing. So we want to know what the building permit, what's the word I'm looking for, the building permit trend, which way it's going. And with respect to multifamily, and that's what we're talking about here, because it could be that there's 10,000 units going up within a community, but 8,000 of those are all in one place. So there will be heavy traffic and heavy competition and likely heavy discounting for a season in that locale where those 8,000 units are going up over the next year. But that means there's only 2,000 units going up around the rest of the community. So it may not necessarily have that big of an impact. It may be built and be a stabilized property from day one, because it was 200 units that were demolished and 150 units put back in the same place. So there's really no change in the housing stock in that community. So you can't just look at building permits, but where those permits are going and if they are actually occurring versus just a permit being pulled for the sake of saying that there's going to be units built here, but it's still 1 year, 2 years away. So building permits and also jobs. Jobs is really, of course, the biggest driver or determinant of rents. The job centers, the proximity to property, the wage scale of the jobs that are being created. So that's another significant pattern with respect to looking at an asset. And then, of course, crime. There's violent crime and there's nonviolent crime, but you know, no one's more angry than when they see their window busted, right, in front of a property. But that's not the same as someone having pointed a gun or something else at you and taking your property off your person. So there's crime and there's violent crime, and there's a significant difference between the two. And there's a significant difference between how the two affect property value. So it's one thing, like I said, if there's cars stolen, it's another if people are really being accosted in that particular area. And it does really have an impact on value. So those are aggregate patterns to look at with respect to to individual properties, but we went in our last podcast from markets, and then this little overview I just provided for you is with respect to patterns within those markets. So now let's talk about class.
All right.
So let's start with A.
Okay.
Class A, everybody thinks they know what a Class A property is. But more often than not, if not anything else, it's usually the latest or the newest product that's been brought to market. It has the latest amenities. It has built-ins. It has more than one pool. And it's also offered at the highest price rents. So that Class A property is usually attempting to capture the highest rents. But if there's an oversupply, then it's no longer significant, right? It's no longer distinguished. So Class A property, in some instances, acts a lot like the next class down if there's an oversupply of that type. And that can occur. I mean, it has occurred in places like Austin where there's been a deluge of Class A properties in downtown. But in other places like San Francisco and Chicago, where in the last 2 years, more than 20,000 people have moved in to within 2 miles of the city center, Class A property is all scooped up. So there's still a very low vacancy rate, even though there's been a high driver in terms of product that's been brought into the market. It hasn't dampened rents in Class A. So the Class A product is getting Class A rents, which is substantially higher than just about anything else.
Hey, John.
So
let me ask you, if in the situation where you've got an oversupply, does a Class A property, if it's not getting Class A rents, is it still a Class A property, or would it?
It's still when you think of it from a buyer's perspective, then it's basically a bargain, right? Because you're getting Class A amenities, even though you're probably not paying much of a premium when there's oversupply over a Class B property. So that would be a bargain for the renter. And that certainly will last for a season, but you know, more often than not, it will eventually rise, and there you'll see a substantial differential in rents between A and B. And when I say substantial, I'm suggesting 20% or more.
Got it.
So, you know, everyday markets, and I'm using that term loosely, will have rents at $1 per square foot, but it's not uncommon in some markets within New York City. And it may not be a Class A building, but it may be a Class A neighborhood with a what we call a legacy asset that's there, meaning it doesn't have all the amenities that a Class A property would. But because it's in a high-profile, highly desirable neighborhood, it will have Class A rents. And the same is true in Pasadena, California, as an example, very well-established community, not a lot of new construction, but legacy properties that were built in the 1950s and 60s that are yet still today just beautiful assets with some upgrades, but they've got, you know, lush landscaping. They still have parking because of when they were built, you know, that was not, there were two spots per unit installed at that location, not, you know, 1.1.
Right.
So they still have great amenities attached to them, but that Class A property in New York City, even though it's not new, I can point to properties that are rented at $77 per square foot, and this is rental.
Right.
So, you know, and New York is a different animal, of course. New York, San Francisco, Boston are different than just about anywhere else in the U.S. because they compete with London, Tokyo, and Dubai. So those international cities, those 24-hour cities, they have a different metric in many respects than just about anywhere else in the United States. But yet there are Class A properties all over the United States. Some are garden, two-story, with beautiful pools and a fitness center and a business center that are 10 years old, and they fit nicely within their community. But yet they're only two stories high in a place like Nashville or Chattanooga even, where you're not going to necessarily see high-rises that or they don't have to be a high-rise to be a Class A building.
Hey, John, you mentioned the size, or you referenced amenities having two pools as kind of a, you know, an indicator. Is there any kind of a unit count or any kind of a thing that would lend itself, or is it a pretty wide range, or is it more amenity based and location based and rent based that
for institutional assets, there were usually they were usually being the 150 to 250 unit count. But that also is evolving in our multifamily marketplace because there are builders now that specialize, as do hoteliers, where they're building what they would call a boutique building. So it may only be 12, 25, 36 units, but because of its location in a suburb of San Francisco, it will still be a newly constructed or redeveloped Class A property in a highly desirable area. But when we're talking about institutional quality assets, those that have 9-foot ceilings and the two pools, as an example, the granite countertops, the hardwood floors, you know, the skylights or faux pas skylights, and floor-to-ceiling windows, you know, amenities such as that, they're just still generally going to be in a development that's 150 to 250 units in size.
Okay. And you also mentioned rents 20% higher. Is that kind of just a rule of thumb that you find that if you're comparing a B to an A, that you would expect 20% above for the A?
I'm providing that as a barometer.
Okay.
That really depends on demand and location, right? I mean, because mm-hmm. Austin is different than Dallas.
Right.
But Dallas has substantially more product. So what's the differential in rents between Class A and Class B? You know, Dallas also has 37 or 38 submarkets, 5 or 6 of which will be dominated by Class A product. And that Class A product has to compete against other Class A product, right? So the prices there for Class A may be 20 or 30% different than just going to Plano or going across, you know, 50 miles further out. Even though it'll still be a Class A product, it's not competing against Class A product within the city center. So that 20% is really an ethereal number. I can't tell you that's the number, the differential between A and B. The real barometer is how much Class A product there is, if there's an oversupply, or is the market in balance. And if there's an oversupply, then those rents will come down closer to Class B rents.
Got it. And I'm assuming, does the evaluating a property for investments, would the cap rates have anything to do with these? I mean, I'm assuming that's still just kind of supply and demand. Is that true?
Well, we're talking about two different things there. I mean, if you're talking about valuations for Class A, B, or C, that's a completely different topic than just identifying them as we're trying to do today.
Right.
But, you know, there's been cap rate suppression. Part of that is based on overextended low interest rates. Part of that is based on an oversupply of equity, sometimes foreign equity, depending on the market, if it's a coastal market. So how long will that last? I don't know. You know, and property values in California, as you're aware, have had their roller coaster ride even over the last 5 years. Whereas in the Midwest, there's been not much difference at all.
Right.
And then you go to the Southeast, and there's home builders that can't build fast enough for people that want to become homeowners all over again. You know, the city of Atlanta is a tale of two cities. The northern half of the city has seen values increase, talking about housing now, not multifamily, that has exceeded the troughs of the recession that we went through. Whereas the southern half of the city, the values are still substantially lower than the lowest prices or where prices fell to during the recession. So speaking to cap rates on Class A, it's still market specific, but it's also capital driven. And I'm suggesting it has more to do with the availability of equity than debt.
Got it. Okay. So as far as a summary for a Class A property, you said newest product on in the market.
Yeah. It's going to newest have, product in the market, latest in amenities, the built-in amenities. It's usually offered at what we would call the highest rent per square foot within the marketplace. Class A property likes to differentiate itself by being best in class, and that's usually true based on having the latest and greatest amenities. And they'll also provide services that will not be offered at any other class of asset, whether it's, the list goes on, but the Class A property will likely have porters. They'll likely have dry cleaning pickup. They'll likely have vehicle servicing, where someone comes to your property, you give them the keys, they take it and change the oil, wash the car, and bring it back. Amenities that you won't find at non-Class A properties.
Got it.
There would be a concierge. I'm not suggesting that all Class A properties have all of these services. This is just a list of things that could be available there. You know, I really think, I'm doing a little segue here, Darren, that the newest services that are just coming online, such as Uber Eats, I think that's going to have a significant impact on how people view where they live. I was in Atlanta several weeks ago and at a very nice restaurant. There was a line of people at the bar, and I just couldn't quite figure that out. The place might have had 50 seats, and the line of people at the bar were Uber drivers waiting for takeout orders.
Really?
So here's people willing to spend, if it's a dinner for two, probably $40 or $50, minus any drinks, and then willing to pay the Uber driver the $5, $10, or $15 for delivery so that they can have dinner at home and not have to come to the restaurant.
Wow.
So what impact will that have on the multifamily marketplace? I don't know. But as more people are able to telecommute and work from where they live, that'll also change the dynamic of where people have an expressed interest in living. Now, looking at it from an old head perspective, the families with children always looked at school districts first and nothing else but school districts, right?
Right.
And then everything else kind of fell into place. But as our population ages and there's fewer families with school-age children, that gives choice a more prominent place with respect to where people find themselves and the options that they have as to where they want to live.
Well, I'm still trying to get my head around the Uber drivers there for the takeout. That's I hadn't heard that
And it's a $50 meal, is what I'm saying. It's not a pizza place or wings being delivered. They're ordering the gourmet burger and the dessert, and they don't want to come into the restaurant.
Right.
Whether they don't, they have the disposable income to make that choice.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. I hadn't thought of that twist on the Uber there, but that changes. That's another change. So, yeah. Well, let's move into the B property.
Okay. So Class B, in many instances, can be one of those legacy assets that I mentioned. From an institutional investor perspective, there are many, many Class B properties in Class A areas. But they cannot refer to the acquisition or to the property that they're looking at as a Class A, if for no other reason than because of age. Even though it may have been redeveloped, it may have been revamped, it has the latest systems in terms of a new roof, it has the latest HVAC because it's been taken out and replaced, flooring's been replaced, locking systems, there's no longer locks, everyone has a key fob. And there's granite countertops and there's, all of these things, it's still difficult to present that to their investor base as a Class A asset. So it's still a B, but it's what they would call a legacy asset because it cannot be replaced. And no one is going to allow that asset to be torn down for something else to be built in its place, even though it's of high quality. So that's what I would call an A-, but it's really a B property. But because of its location and because of the amenities that it's offering, it looks like an A, but because of the age of the property, it has to be considered a B product. So B product represents various degrees of product types, but the age is really the key component. But it's usually a well-maintained property. You won't see any deferred maintenance. But yet a Class B property can still rent for $500 in one market, $2,500 in another market, even though it's still a B. Institutional professionals, will still, because of that age issue, call it a B class property.
John, what's
if it's older than 20 years?
Oh, 20 years. I was going to ask you, what was the...
Yeah, 20 years or older.
Okay.
Right. So there's many a Class A property that can still be considered a Class A, even though it's 14, 15 years old. But once it gets past that 20-year mark, then there's going to be significant changes to building materials, and that's what kind of passes it on to the next class.
Got
so it's
it.
A very, you know, the Class B is a very narrow classification because there is a big difference between, you know, Appleton, Wisconsin, and Pasadena, California. But a Class B is a Class B. It can be a quality product, but generally speaking, it's older than 20 years and has very limited deferred maintenance. So it's nice, clean, and neat, and it has the things that you need, but it may not have the latest and greatest that you need.
John, I know when you were describing the institutional definitions, is it common, do you find that institutional investors will plan their exit from an A property prior to turning past the 20 years or becoming 20 years old?
I don't know how to answer that, really. It's, you know, every investor is different. They all have their marching orders. Some investors have very long and patient capital. Others, they've really got to churn and burn. The real issue with dispositions or sales of these legacy assets in particular, I mean, yes, it can be sold, but where are you going to put your money?
Right.
Where does that money go once you exit? So that, in this low interest environment, hard to capture yield environment, that keeps a lot of the larger institutions remaining in the product that they already have. Because let's say that they can make a significant internal rate of return and it looks good on paper. Well, gulp, they've got to reinvest those monies, those dollars, and do something similar, right? So
right.
The motivations are different. So I really can't speak to investor motivations as wide and as varied as they are. But selling an asset, if you're in the business full-time and long-term, selling an asset means that you likely have a better opportunity, right? You have a better place to put that equity capital. And if you don't, then you're probably going to keep that asset another year.
Got it. Is there any, so we talked about the age, does that naturally then drop off if you're not a legacy, you know, property? Would that, again, the wide spread of options, would you naturally expect just a significantly lesser amount of amenities in a B? Or if it was a legacy, then I suppose you'd consider it to, or you would expect it to still have quite a few of the A-type amenities?
I would expect a legacy asset, even of B quality, to have a lot of the amenities that a Class A property has, such as concierge, such as wireless internet, property-wide, you know, including in common areas and such. But that Class B could be a 1962-built development. The real question is, if it's in a Class A market, is it ripe for redevelopment? And if it is, then it will bring with it those Class A amenities, right, with higher rents. But from an institutional perspective, it still will not be considered a Class A asset. It will be considered a legacy asset.
Got it. As you move through the B from the high end, kind of a legacy, can you describe what you would expect to find kind of like more down towards the bottom of B, like a B minus?
A B minus is a, so we're moving towards C. So
right.
A B minus would be an asset that has some deferred maintenance, but it's still in a very safe neighborhood.
Okay, so location would be kind of the key indicator there as far as a whether or not a property were B or a C. Is that fair?
Well, once we get to C, we're talking about it. What's known in the vernacular as workforce housing.
Okay.
So people that are in workforce housing are generally making an hourly wage. And I know we all make an hourly wage, but you know, professionals are usually paid on an annual salary amount, right?
Right.
Whereas folks that are working on an hourly wage, they may or may not work 40 hours a week. They may work 30 hours a week at one position and 15 hours a week in another, or 15 and 15, or 20 and 20. But they're usually making an hourly wage, and their employment is not as stable as those with a college degree. So workforce housing and Class C properties, kind of go hand in hand. So these are people that are working, but in a major city, they may be referred to as the working poor, because everybody knows what that is. That's that person that's working paycheck to paycheck, right? If they don't work next week, they don't get paid next week, and they have to figure out how to pay the bills the following week regardless. So that workforce housing it's substantially functional, but it will likely have some, if not a lot, of deferred maintenance. And the credit quality of the residents that live there, even though it may be good or can be good, the turnover is going to be higher because of their job instability. And the job instability of the resident base is what I'm referring to. So those properties will have higher turnover. They'll have higher deferred maintenance. You know, the qualifications for entry are not as stringent because the Class C properties does have that higher turnover and is usually going to have a little bit higher vacancy rate. But again, we have to go back to the markets, because in some markets, because there's such a significant differential in rents between B and C, C properties are in high demand. So let me just pick on Kansas City for an example, because it's close to where I reside, and I know it well enough to make these comments. You can live within 10 miles within 5 miles of a job center, and a one bedroom in one part of town will be $900, and a one bedroom in another part of town will be $550. It's the same number of square feet. It's a substantially different property type, B versus C. But if you're working in the same location, remember both of those properties are within 5 miles of the same job center, that's a pretty significant lifestyle choice, right?
Right.
I mean, it's not $100 a month. It's more than $100 a month. And where do you want to put those dollars? Do you want to spend $900 on the one bedroom? Or are you okay in a neighborhood that's not quite as nice, that's 40% less, which is enough to pay for your automobile and your automobile insurance if you're making the same wage?
Right.
So people make choices. So that workforce housing is not necessarily bad housing. It's not necessarily crime-ridden or has other significant issues. It's just not going to be as nice as the B. It's going to have some deferred maintenance. You know, maintenance requests may get done within the same week versus within the same day. It's a different mentality, but it's also a different qualifier in terms of the way that the property is being managed.
Got it. So is management a key difference between the B and the C then as well? I mean, you mentioned the speed at which, like, repairs might be attended to. And I mean, obviously, you've clearly defined the lower barred entry into a Class C property. Is it based on that just the clientele and what their level of expectation is that allows management to do that or to manage differently?
Well, it's also a matter of competition also, right? If we pick those same markets in Kansas City, there may be 8,000 units that are C and 2,000 units that are B within that same submarket. And that's a little high for a smaller market like Kansas City. But let's say there's 2,000 units that are C and 400 units that are B. Competition for the B units may not necessarily be that heavy because of what we just mentioned, the significant price differential. So the B units may actually come down a little bit in an effort to compete if their occupancy is not where they want it to be. But with respect to your question, I'm not going to take the easy route and say, yes, it's all about management, because that would be very easy and everyone would shake their head and agree with that. But that's really not the case. The real issue is the inner workings between ownership and management. So management can only, to a degree, accomplish what ownership allows them to accomplish. So you may have a stellar management company that's managing 1,000 units, and 80% of their units are just right on the mark. And they've got an owner with 200 units that just flat out won't spend a dollar on anything. I mean, they just won't. So keep the lights on, keep the doors open, but if the door is squeaking, do not send anybody over there to fix that squeak. I don't want to spend the money. So then the property manager is kind of in the middle, right? Do they want to retain that client, that fee-paying client that represents 20% of their business, and go along and play along? Or do they want to exit and say, you know, this is not the way that we manage our assets. As much as we'd like to retain your business, Mr. and Mrs. Owner, we will not do so at that level of service. That's a big decision for a property management company. So it's not always property management in the way that they prefer to handle things. Sometimes ownership is the edict and they make that determination. And the property manager has to decide if they want to live within that bell curve or not.
Right. Now that makes a lot of sense. Hey, before we move on here, I want to ask you quick. You mentioned the rate of turnover for a C is pretty high. Can you draw a comparison or what you would expect moving up to a B or an A property as far as the volume of turnover?
It's more market specific than it is property specific. But the real factor in terms of the level of turnover, job stability is really the biggest factor in terms of the level of turnover. So if you're in a market or with properties that have, as I shared earlier, people that have multiple jobs and have an hourly paycheck, they're far more likely to move sooner than those that have a higher income or a more stable income, I should say, and are not as apt to turn over as much.
Got it. So the tenant income is kind of more of a driver for the frequency of turnover.
I'm using that as opposed to just utilizing the standard of, you know, well, what are rents and how much are they rising? So in properties where they're using lease revenue optimization software and they know they can get $200 more per unit year over year, sometimes that turnover is created by management, right, to capture additional dollars. So you're renting for $1,100 a month and you're willing to pay $1,150 per month, and the management company comes back and says, no, your renewal is at $1,350. Well, you're going to start looking at other options very likely, right?
Right.
So sometimes the turnover is created by management and not by residents.
Got it. Okay, so the kind of what I'm drawing from on the C property, one thing that you mentioned that I appreciate you mentioning was just the still going to be a safe neighborhood, more deferred maintenance, and it's basically housing more of your working poor? I guess working poor is what I wrote down.
Well, that's when you say workforce housing, people use that as a generic for a lot of different people that are all along the income scale. But that workforce housing terminology, from my perspective, is really referring to those people that do not have stable employment, that likely have one or more jobs, or they may not have full-time employment. So it may be two roommates, right, that are both working at Walmart and they've got great benefits and good job stability, but they're still working for an hourly wage.
Right.
No, nothing wrong with that at all, right? So it's not necessarily what you refer to as the working poor. It's working people that have a profession, but it's at that scale and level where if they left Walmart and went to Target, they'd still be doing the same work. They're not necessarily going to, you know, go up the ladder within their profession in a short period of time. They're going to stay in that same income mode.
Got it. All right. So from C, do we go to D?
From C, we go to everything else.
Everything else. Okay.
So everything else is those high crime properties that nobody can fix. It's the four-story walk-up without an elevator. It's the 1940s duplex. You know, it's all the things that don't look like an A, B, or C. But it's still relevant housing, right? People are still living there. It could be a converted basement. It could be a fourplex where there's actually five families living there, and the fifth family is in the basement, and that's not even a unit on the tax rolls.
Right.
You know, in major metropolitans, there are people that are living in garages that have bathroom privileges in the house, right? And they're paying $600 a month.
Right.
So there's all these other rentals that are not A, B, or C multifamily, that are not single family rentals. They're just everything else. So the credit quality, the rents, there's really no single barometer. There isn't single family, of course, but for all of these others, it's more ad hoc than anything else.
Does the configuration of the property, you know, the I can't tell you how many times I've looked around and the explanation from the owner, the seller, the manager is nothing's uniform, you know, kind of thing. Does that lend itself to more of an everything else class?
It does. It really does. Yeah. Well, when I'm referring to class A, B, and C, I'm still, for the most part, referring to those developments that are 150 units or higher, right, in terms of unit count, that have that form of that port of uniformity in addition to the other things we mentioned for A, B, and C. So there's ample numbers of 48-unit buildings, 84-unit buildings all across the country. But going under those 100 units, you know, initially, if nothing else, you begin to lose economies of scale. So it takes the same number of people to manage an 84-unit building as it does 150-unit building. Probably one additional person to manage double the number of units. So they have their idiosyncrasies that make them more difficult to manage based on not having that economies of scale.
Got it. Let me ask you this, as far as the range from A to everything else, would you expect to find A properties in all markets, or would that be more of your, from our prior podcast, from, you know, primary and secondary markets, or would you expect A-type properties in tertiary as well?
I'd say you can expect to find Class A properties in markets of 50,000 or higher, at least one or two, and even small markets of 50,000 or higher. But it may not be that institutional quality size of 150 units or higher. Now, it may well be a 32-unit brand-new development with all the amenities, a boutique development, but it's still just 32 units. So it's Class A for that market, but it doesn't fit the institutional quality Class A moniker, if for no other reason, because of size.
Based on the size of the market.
Right. So Des Moines, Iowa is 200,000 people. I'm sure there's some Class A properties there, but there's not going to be very many.
Right, right. Got it. Well, that's a pretty clear-cut. Well, I don't want to say clear-cut, but it definitely gives some definition to the different class of properties. Is there anything that we haven't touched on when you're looking at the different classes of properties that we should have mentioned?
Well, for institutional buyers, they're really looking at these assets from a market-specific perspective rather than just through the exclusive lens of class. So class alone, you can't use that as your exclusive watermark for acquisitions, but it's really good to have a working knowledge of class to assist you in defining the competitive forces. And those competitive forces are differentiated in many instances by the cost per square foot in rent, right? So we can look at Class C in the Midwest and recognize it's going to be at 50 or 60 cents per square foot, whereas Class C in a major city will still be a dollar or more per square foot. And then you go up from there. So as I mentioned, you know, there's properties that are those legacy assets, high-quality assets that are older in New York and the like, where rents are $60 and $70 per square foot for a rental. And this is per month.
Right, right.
Per rent per square foot per month. In places such as Chicago, a nice Class B property may rent at $2 per square foot.
Right. Now, very market specific.
Very market specific, yes.
Yeah. Well, another good indicator, or I guess kind of differentiation for understanding the different markets. So people that are getting in their own kind of, you know, working their way up on the market, probably most likely if you're a first time multifamily investor and you're trying to get into some units, I'm assuming you're probably going to be starting off in a C property just based on, you know, the numbers, unless you're able to raise significant amount of capital, whether through syndication or else. I mean, like you said, the Class A is naturally going to go to more of your institutional investors, correct?
Yes, and very often on an all-cash basis. So they're competing against one another.
Right, and they're just not to say they're not using.
Yeah, not to say they're not using financing, but yeah, the guys like you and me are not out there buying Class A on our own account.
Right.
So if we're buying them, we're buying them on behalf of pensions, on behalf of trusts, on behalf of partnerships, et cetera.
Right.
The B class assets are available to the everyday man and woman. But if they're of size, it still can be a $10 or $20 million deal.
Right.
No, it's not going to be something small. So, you know, if you're just looking to get into the rental market, the best of all worlds is to buy a duplex and live in half and rent out the other half. If you've just never been in the rental business at all before, just to get your feet wet and at the same time learn a little bit about management and have some income other than your own to pay for the mortgage for the place you're living in. So that's the very basic, but for rental property, multifamily, under 100 units, there's always the issue of economies of scale and management. So you can't just look at the property. You have to look at your ability or the capacity of your marketplace to manage that asset. Because if you're not in the business of management and you buy 64 units, then someone has to manage that asset for you. And you need to find out who those people are and have coffee with them and invite them to lunch and see who they are and how they tick and how they work. Otherwise, you'll have bought this building and now you've also got to manage it.
Right. Yeah. And if you don't know what you're doing, then you're
already sunk.
Yeah. You're not in a good, not in a good place. Not in a good place.
Right.
So, well, John, go ahead.
Well, that's not to deter people from buying units under 100. It's just a matter of fact to recognize that there's a different management component with smaller assets. That's all.
Right.
More intensive.
Right. And I know, as it's been explained to me in the past, is on some of the smaller units, you do have the opportunity to learn if something and I say smaller, talking more like your duplexes and stuff, you have the opportunity to learn all about it before you get into something where the numbers matter significantly greater, or you know, just the magnitude of it, and you know, kind of have a good sense of what is and how it works, so that you can even know or recognize what the manager is or is not doing, and come at it from there.
So. Yeah, property management is a profession. You can't just learn it on a weekend.
No.
Agreed. It doesn't work that way. Yeah.
Agreed. Well, John, this has been very enlightening, and I'm sure the listeners will find this useful and complimentary to our last episode there. And I'll be sure to cue that up so people remember to take a listen to that. John, what's the best way for listeners to get in touch with you if they'd like to reach out to you?
Well, I'm easiest to find on Amazon because I've written several books related to rent roll analysis and multifamily acquisitions, market analysis, financing, and property management. So just look up John Wellhoit on Amazon.com, or you can go to my blog, multifamilyinsight.net. And from there, if you wanted to send me an email, if you had a question or something, just pop me a note from multifamilyinsight.net.
Got it. Hey, John, thanks a bunch, and we'll look forward to doing this again soon.
Yes, sir. 2017 is around the corner.
All right, John. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed that. John is a tremendous wealth of information in multifamily. And if you're new to multifamily, or if you have clients that are looking for a greater understanding of the market, I highly recommend you check out John's website and his books. There's links in the show notes. You can find, if you go ahead and type in John Wellhoit on Amazon.com, you can find his books, or you can go to his website, multifamilyinsight.net. That's all we have for you today. We know you're busy. We thank you for making time for us. We do appreciate you. Until next time, thanks for listening to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio.
You're listening to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals. For more information on this or any of our guests, like us on Facebook, CREPN Radio.